This is an ABC podcast.
Grandstand Cricket Podcast time with your boys, Corbin Middlemass and Ed Cowan, for your Monday. The Australian Summer of Cricket has begun in earnest, and the ultimate Summer of Cricket starts with a victory. The Aussies victorious last night against India. Of course, we are 32 short days away from the Ashes beginning. Cannot wait for it. Thanks to Trent Copeland for being in this seat last week. Well, maybe Ed Cowan was in this seat and we sort of, everyone's in slightly musical chairs, but bands back together for 1 week only, at least in the lead up to the Ashes beginning. Ed Cowan is in Sydney. Hello, Teddy.
Corb, oh my goodness, so good to have you back. I mean, just to get a little glimpse of how hard it is to sit in your chair.
Yeah.
Walk in a man's shoes for a day.
Steer the conversation and everything else. And to think I was doing that in between 86 games of footy. It's unbelievable.
Unbelievable. You are remarkable. You're a remarkable human. What did, I don't know, did you catch the episode at all? Any
I did.
Feedback?
No, I thought it was excellent. I actually was pottering around my folks' place and had it on times 1.5. Just speed through the episode, make sure I got all my analysis. I saw you called the race over. Marnie's plane.
It's done.
Over.
Yeah. We can come to our rating system in a second. I actually listen back. I don't usually listen back, but I listen back. Thought, you know, there's always little moments for improvement if I'm going to have to sit in the great man's chair. Mm. First thing that it came across my ears, my sound quality was terrible. I need the studio setup that you have. But it's harder than you think. I mean, well done.
Thank you. I'm in Perth today, so I did the ODI yesterday, but I've actually had a busy week over here in WA. So I went to the wrestling, which I know you would be a big fan of, Teddy. You'd be a WWE fan.
Well, like WWE wrestling.
Was in
like
town.
Old style wrestling, not Greco-Roman.
No. They had three big events. I went to two of them. So it was great fun with an old friend of mine, and then had a wedding down south. So congratulations to my good friend Max and his beautiful bride, Beck. I understand you're a big sucker for a wedding, aren't you?
Oh my goodness. I can't not cry at weddings. That's a fun fact. That's a fun fact about me. Every single wedding, doesn't matter, best friend, you know, distant relative, floods of tears.
Yeah,
special times, they're beautiful.
They are. I was lucky enough to be in the bridal party, so I was blaming the hay fever and all sorts of things at different times. It was a really, really awesome wedding down south, beautiful part of the world, the southwest of WA. So the wedding was down in Yellingup. And then I was here for the ODI. But I just want to shout out a couple of people I ran into during the week. So Matt, who came and said g'day at the wrestling, big fan of the cricket podcast, and I just assumed, oh, he must be a West Australian. He said, no, I studied journalism in Melbourne. I've flown over just for the wrestling. So he was over there for the weekend. So shout out to Matt, who I'm sure is listening, and to Chris as well, who stopped me on my run yesterday. I was out for a little trot, trying to keep up with the Marnus Labuschagne bandwagon, and shouted out to me, was out there walking his dog, and actually trotted along with me and said he was a big fan of yours and big Richmond supporter, but loves the Grandstand Cricket Podcast. So big Teddy fans over here in the West and all around the country, Ed. You'll be pleased to know.
That's, I mean, fans come in all shapes and sizes. The highlight of my week, Corb, I had 48 hours in Los Angeles.
Who goes to LA for 48 hours? It takes you longer to get there and back.
That's a sidebar. But QF11 on the way over, Jack, the flight attendant, bowls up in Gosford and helps run the committee over there. So there are cricket fans in all parts of the globe and above the globe in this respect. I know you're off to the US soon, so maybe you could have the honour of Jack looking after you. That was superb. Good fella, cricket lover, love the pod. It's when you least expect it, people just pop up out of nowhere and want to talk cricket.
The only thing I'm a little concerned about in my prospect of running into Jack is he might be looking after a different cabin from where you sit and where I sit, Teddy. So maybe that might keep us apart on these flights to LA.
I'll get him to run you down a Diet Coke, don't worry.
All right, we are here to talk a little bit of cricket. We might start with the ODI. So obviously with the heaps happening in the Sheffield Shield, we'll get to that in the lead up to the Ashes series. But I was here for the ODI yesterday, and boy, was it a frustrating day, as rain interruptions always are. Basically, over a 4 hour and 17 minute stretch, we got 38 minutes of cricket, Teddy, broken up into three different pockets with four rain delays. The first innings of the match, took almost 6 hours to complete. It started at 11:30, and it basically wasn't done until after 5:30 to be able to get the end of that first innings complete. And so India, incredibly disadvantaged, not just lost the toss, but then also lost early wickets, were up against it. Then, you know, overs kept getting shaved off the innings as we went through. And the Aussies, yeah, typically relentless. Their bowlers look superb again, Hazelwood and Stark, and then obviously the support from Alison Kuhneman, and even Mitch Owen bowled a few overs on ODI debut. And then so the Aussies knew exactly what they needed, 131. The revised target came down. That's a whole sidebar conversation, which I can't get my head around. Marsh made 46, Philippi a little eye-popping 37, and Matt Renshaw ultimately hit the winning runs and got some red ink. So pretty comprehensive win for the Aussies. It's India's first defeat in the format, Teddy, since August 2024. They'd won 8 in a row, and the Aussies had won only 2 of their last 10 ODIs. So Australia's 50-over form hadn't been overly special. So nice start for the Aussies to a huge summer of cricket.
Huge summer of cricket. I must say that four-hour on-and-off delay ensured that it lost my attention pretty quickly, and it got too late over in the east to watch live. So I caught the highlights this morning, but a few things stood out to me. I mean, you talked about the Aussie form going in. It's kind of meaningless the way they've set this team up outside of World Cup cycles, essentially. And yesterday we saw, you know, a bit of a mix and match. You saw Hazelwood and Stark essentially using it as a high-intensity warm-up match for the Ashes. Big tick, so obviously the team benefits from that. And then a bit of a mishmash of players through the middle order for a variety of reasons. But I actually quite like how this team sets up with the bat. It's close to their T20 team than it is a traditional 50-over team. And that's the way the game's headed in terms of tactically. And so, you know, I don't mind people kind of look at that team and say, you know, Mitch Owen, you know, hasn't done much. We've done plenty now in T20 format. And there's a variety of other selections through that middle order that, you know, you think, oh, what have they done to be in the national team? But I don't mind them around the setup. The team shaped up well and ultimately played with the energy required to knock off a good Indian team.
Do you know what does make any side look good is when you have probably the most devastating opening combination in world white ball cricket. I think if you've got Marsh and Head opening in the T20 and 50-over version of the game, that's a pretty good platform, isn't it? And then you can stack the rest of them however you want to put them. So they've got, you know, Philippi and Short, who are a white ball openers, basically coming into the middle. Even Renshaw's down there at number 5. Mitch Owen, who obviously opens in short form cricket, listed at 7. So this is obviously not new for Australian cricket, not new for world cricket, where guys that often open in, you know, for their domestic setup find themselves batting in the middle and lower order for the national team. And there's a boatload of guys, even with the retirements of Smith and Maxwell and Stoinis, that will still come back in. The two other keepers, Inglis and Carey, will be back in the setup, you think, in the not too distant future. So there's reinforcements to come for this team.
Yeah, for sure. And it's interesting, you know, Mitch Marsh has found himself to the top of the order purely out of what he's done in the shortest format, rather than you know, finding his way there naturally in 50-over cricket. You know, the role that he's played in that team over many years, but it sets up nicely, as I said. So, I mean, you know my view more broadly on ODIs. I don't really understand. Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Love them to death. So I can't wait to get through the next two to get onto the T20. Yeah. They should just play 7 T20s.
Yeah, I don't mind it. Yep, yeah, like a big sort of NBA-style, you know, final series, and don't mind it. And if you're Cricket Australia, you couldn't get a better summer, could you? Like, to be able to have India for 8 white ball games where, and I always say, you know, India never plays a road game, and that was sort of true again yesterday. There's 40,000 there. There would have been 30-plus thousand supporting India and wearing blue. So, again, sort of huge support. So you get all that supporting people through the gates for this series, and then probably the biggest test series there is, where, you know, a lot of Australian cricket fans, you know, their format of the game that they love and still hold closest to their heart is test cricket, and there's no more richer rivalry than the Ashes. So what a combination to have them both in the same summer.
It is literally a 5 gold star summer. Interestingly, you know, we talk about the demise of ODI cricket, but financially, you know, it's interesting if you kind of peel back the curtain, so to speak. You know, a game like yesterday produces probably somewhere between 1.5 and 2 times the revenue a full test match produces against India. So same opponent, but one day, and it's about the same for T20. So there's no real difference in revenue generation between T20 cricket and ODI cricket back into India. So
is that right?
It is, yeah, they're important games for a whole variety of reasons, but my preference is more T20.
Yeah.
Let's actually make a move on ODI cricket. But the show, you know, for listeners of this podcast for the last, I don't know how long we've been doing it, 6 or 7 years, our biggest bugbear has been scheduling, or one of our biggest bugbears. We've had a few. But the shape of the summers and how they're taking shape of the last two, let's get the white ball fixtures out of the way, October, early November, into the test season, into the big bat. You know, there can still be some tweaks made, but generally the shape of the summer is far better as a fan of the game. So we're getting there slowly.
I agree. Matt Renshaw and Mitch Owen both made their ODI debuts. I find Renshaw a fascinating conversation where he was this prodigy in the test team, wasn't he? He scored 100 at 20 years of age, and then he makes his debut in a different format of the game, almost as a completely different player. He's someone that's had a couple of false dawns in the test team, has had to go back to domestic cricket, had a terrible run of form in the middle there, had to kind of rebuild his game, and now he's at 29. It feels like the graph's sort of up and to the right again at this particular stage, and he gets the opportunity to debut for Australia and have sort of a new first this late in his career. So, well, when I say this late in his career, still only 29. You think he's probably still got a good half a dozen seasons left yet of playing high-level cricket.
Yeah, for sure. I think I saw a stat. This is the biggest gap between debuts in two different in the history of cricket. And so you're right. What is a full decade? And at the time when he made that 100, he looked like a 100 test player at the time. And he's had a bit of a wild journey since then. I still am a big believer that he has a lot to contribute in the longer format. I know you still need to be convinced and see some more runs on the board, but his white ball form domestically has been superb. And so he's earned this spot. This isn't a whim and a prayer of being the next batter in. It's someone who's actually genuinely earned that spot, and it's good to see him get a go. Because often this ODI team, they are, picking it. There's more likelihood of a random bolter or, a Cooper Connolly who definitely hasn't earned his spot, but he's picked on talent. And, we don't need to necessarily talk about that specifically, but you compare that with Matt Renshaw, who has dominated white ball domestic cricket and is now getting opportunity. So it's nice to have a mix of those players. Correct. And there is some talent density coming through in Australian cricket.
And once upon a time, Renshaw was Connolly. Like, there was a stage in his career where he was that guy got the opportunities early on, and now he's sort of had to force his way back in by weight of runs. Just on the DLS, like, there are people out there that'll kind of defend this and basically say, oh, you got to understand the system. You can explain it to me within an inch of its life as to how it's all calculated and everything else. Still doesn't make any sense. You are so disadvantaged in a rain-affected game by batting first. Like we look at what happened yesterday, and I get, India didn't help themselves. They lost early wickets, and immediately they found themselves behind in the game. But how many more times are we going to then knock off runs, disadvantage the side that bats first? I mean, they found themselves, I wrote this down, given I was broadcasting the game yesterday. This game got shortened multiple times with four different rain delays. It went from 49 overs to 35 to 32 to 26. And at that particular stage, as India are kind of losing wickets, I mean, if you knew when you started batting that it was a 26-over game, the approach would be completely different. And instead, they get to the end of their 26 overs when it finally came to a close. They were 9 for 136, and their score goes backwards. I'll never get my head around it. You can sit there and draw it up on the whiteboard and do everything. How does it end up with 131? And then the team that bats second knows exactly what they've got. They've got all 10 wickets, and they've got less runs to chase than what India were able to make in overall across their innings that was chopped up multiple times.
Yeah, I can't help you or create any clarity here, Corbin, unfortunately. So, I mean, a few things come to mind is, and we've definitely talked about this in the past, is they've obviously added the S to the what was the Duckworth-Lewis, now Duckworth-Lewis-Stern, and is meant to account better for shorter games with the advent of T20. You know, it is actually the shorter the game gets, the more ridiculous Duckworth-Lewis gets. And I don't understand necessarily the maths as to how that happens. And I also think the advent of T20 cricket has allowed teams to play better, particularly when they're batting second, understand the ebbs and flows of what a 25 over innings looks like. And so with the convergence of ODI cricket and the T20 cricket, they almost need to go back to the starting point, I think, and try and reinvent what this looks like. So they obviously have all this data in the background. You know, it seems reasonable and it's been tested over many years, but the game is changing dramatically.
Mm.
So it would be probably worth going back to first principles, I think.
Yeah.
I don't know what the answer is.
Yeah. I understand if, say, you don't get any bonus, but given the fact you lost early wickets, that's on you. You struggled and everything else. I don't understand how you can go backwards. Like, it just doesn't make any sense to me. At the end of the day, they batted their 26 overs. That's what they made. They made that many amount of runs. And the fact that they didn't know how long there was to go or whatever else, how do you all of a sudden say, oh, we actually think you made too many, given you the understanding of the scenario? It just zero. Again, I could be here having someone explain it to me for hours and hours on end, and I still wouldn't be able to get my head around it.
Usually in rain delays, there's plenty of chit chat and time in the press box to have a little bit of a gossip as to, you know, what people are thinking about the upcoming season or unpick certain issues. What was the news of the day? What were people talking about while you were twiddling your thumbs?
Wouldn't believe it. We did speak about who should open the batting in the Ashes. That came up at one particular stage.
Okay, and what was the chitty chat?
I think from Matt, well, I know from Darren Lehman said he's got it down to two. Matt Renshaw, he's a big Renshaw supporter, or Mitch Marsh. So I know Michael Vaughan's been big on this as well, but he said, look, you could do a lot worse than having Mitch Marsh open the batting, almost the Baz Ball effect seeping through.
What? Of the two names I thought you were going to give me,
mm-hmm.
Renshaw and Marsh were not the two that I was expecting. That is, I mean, I disagree with
you.
I'm a Renshaw fan, I'm a Mitch Marsh fan, but neither of those names are in the realms of possibility. To be honest, mm-hmm. if Mitch Marsh was to play, I just don't know how you can correlate opening the batting T20 and ODI cricket with Test cricket.
So it has been a school of thought that's been put out there that's basically, just send him out there, let him tee off from the start and...
You might as well do that with Cameron Green and then you get a better balance around Labuschagne at three and Webster can hold his spot at six. Like that, there's a pecking order and that would be a huge leapfrog. Huge leapfrog.
Mm-hmm.
And the same with Renshaw. It's just disregarding everything you know. That's a very English view of the world where we're just going to hand pick a select few as to with no basis around how or why. That makes no sense to me.
Do you think there's... I don't think it'll be their first choice plan, but do you think it's a break glass option? If all of a sudden they find themselves getting to Melbourne or Sydney and, you know, the series is alive or whatever else to go, you know what, let's insert him like almost they did last Ashes series and he came in and played an explosive innings and helped Australia?
No.
Okay.
I don't. I think it's just like absolute alien talk. I'm still trying to process.
It's gathering momentum, though. I mean, Boof's not the only one that's been trying to or has pushed it out there. And
okay, but someone you can go to. Let's say, obviously, what I'm reading here is they're not K-Gun fans. That's fine. Okay.
Yep.
How about Jake Weatherald, who has got runs on the board? He's just got a 100 for Australia A. He was the leading run scorer.
That was
and he plays
Terry
a
Alderman's,
very aggressive style of cricket.
Terry Alderman's vote was Jake. Okay. So he pushed him forward. But I think the general consensus from Boof and others is that they don't feel like Constance's game is ready at this stage to be playing Test cricket from what they've seen from him so far.
I think that's a decent decent view to hold. It's then, okay, where to from there? And it's the big delta between Sam isn't in the team and who he is that I can't quite come head around. Because there are some high-quality batters in between that. And I don't mind the idea of putting some pressure on the bowlers, but that's out there. I'd rather Travis Head opens than Mitch Marsh.
Yep. So my read at the moment of the entire scenario is that what happens with the health of Cam Green is mm-hmm. actually going to determine what happens at the top of the order. Is that a far-fetched thing to say? So basically, what I believe...
I think I said it last week.
Well, there you go.
You weren't listening that closely, evidently.
Did you say that last week?
I think what I said last week, or maybe I intimated it,
yeah,
was...
Oh, here we go. I've got to try and...
massage
comprehend it,
yeah.
it and everything else.
Yeah,
and
that's right.
Distill the ideas.
It was if Cam Green is not... not fully fit, and by mm-hmm. that I mean he's available to play but has bowling restrictions, I think Bo Webster plays because they need the bowling.
Yep.
If Cam Green is fully fit and has full availability of overs, I think they're probably leaning for him to bat at six and to play Marnus at three and to find someone else to open the batting. So
that's,
I agree with that, but that's my frame of reference for the moment.
Yep. That's where I'm at. I think Marnus is a lock. I think you and I see that the same way. And I think it's either Webster and Green together, or it's Webster or Green. And then if it's Webster or Green, that opens the door for someone else at the top of the order. I think
And that someone else, just quickly in my mind at the moment, is Weatherald ahead of Constance. That could change this week for the record, but the rest are done. So we can kind of
I agree with that. I feel like that they want to play Sam Constance. They want him to be there. Like if he scores runs or whatever in the next few weeks, they'll absolutely pick him. I don't feel like they want to leave him out. And so that would be the option that they would rather play Constance over Webster, and that would be the makeup of the lineup. But as you said, if either Green's not fit and they're going to need Webster, Constance is probably the one that misses out. Or if he looks all at sea. It was interesting that the Greg Shippard comments. I don't know if you caught up with these on the back of the Sheffield Shield match. So he made a handy 50 in the second innings, was put on a 90-run opening stand with Blake Nicotaris, was dismissed, and it triggered a little collapse. They lost 3-for-3. And Greg Shipper, the coach of New South Wales, said in the aftermath, he's a baby cricketer in terms of experience who learned a couple of lessons. Our batters really from none for 90 let a beautiful position slip dramatically and disappointingly. Both openers got out in disappointing fashion, and that opened the door for Victoria, who ultimately went on to win the game. And their dominance over New South Wales continues in Shield cricket. So 14-2 is the head-to-head record in their last 16 games. The Vics all over New South Wales.
Yeah, all over them. And Boland all over Constance. I think he basically knocks him over just by looking at him every time that they play against each other. So I think that was a good summary. None for 90 chasing... 230, they should have cruised home, and then Sam a little bit rash against Todd Murphy opens a little door. Matt Jilks gets a terrible decision against him. I'm sure people have seen it on social media. We can kind of get into the merits of that, but how an umpire could ever determine that his foot was off the ground when the bails were off, considering his foot was off the ground for probably less than 0.2 of a second, is beyond me. And they lose 4-for-8 and lose the game. But an experienced pro ices that game. You're 54 not out, best batting conditions of the game. You get 120, you win the game. You're probably man of the match. You probably play in a test match.
Yeah.
And he just misread the situation. The cricket smarts, the nous, all those little 1% factors that make great cricketers, and they make great, not just domestic cricketers, but great international cricketers, those ingredients are missing from his game at the moment. I don't think anyone could ever say anything other than that. But, I guess the bet that you're making is that he learns that in international cricket, and you invest in that for the future, and you're better off, making those mistakes while other people can carry him a little bit. But whether or not you do that in a big series, and this is the discussion, wouldn't you have preferred for him to make those mistakes against a pop gun Sri Lankan team rather than, the England setup? So I actually think Weatherall's ahead of Constance, personally, in where they're thinking, and it's up to Sam to get some runs to probably change that view.
Steve Smith's going to play the next two games, so he's on his way back from New York, of course, where he resides these days. So that's good news for New South Wales that he's going to be back for their next couple of games. How did the sub work? Were we happy with it? With Sean Abbott, unfortunately, split the webbing in his hand. He was substituted out of the game. Charlie Stobo came in on the opening day, in the very early moments of play. Victoria had the opportunity to make the reciprocal sub. They ultimately didn't do so. Big deal, no big deal, tick, cross. What did you think?
I think the fact that it ended up as no big deal suggests that it was probably, it's something that we could keep investing in as a thought bubble. The game just went on, and no one really blinked. I think that it's pretty thoughtful as to how it's initiated. I was, and interesting that Victoria just let that play out and they were happy with where they were positioned in the game, and that was that. I think if the scores were slightly different, if New South Wales had made a score in the first innings, maybe they could have tactically subbed someone else in, but who knows?
I think everybody's so on the lookout for it to be exploited that, and in this kind of scenario, it's exactly what it's meant for. You lose someone early in the game, ultimately it doesn't have a huge bearing on the outcome. New South Wales already disadvantaged by the fact that Sean Abbott's a better bowler than whoever comes in to replace him. So you do lose one of your frontline guys. There's a reason he was in the team to begin with. There's also a stand down period, so Abbott can't play now for the next 12 days. So it's not like you can roll him out in your next game. So I thought it worked seamlessly, and I think the Cricket Australia have done a great job at sort of tying in all those other riders on it to make sure that it's not exploited. Given but obviously every time there's a new rule, we always think about how that's going to happen. South Australia and Queensland, a rematch of last year's Sheffield Shield final. The Bulls flipping the result on South Australia, so they win by 7 wickets. Shout out to Mitch Swepson too, who I've always been a big fan of his cricket. So 10 wickets, he's never had a better day than this. I think he's taken 10 wickets once previously, but slightly more expensive. 42.2 overs in the second inning, 6 for 109. Also broke a little record in the process, Teddy. He surpasses Trevor Holmes for the most amount of wickets ever taken by a Queensland spinner in first-class cricket. So no spinner has ever taken more wickets now than Mitch Swepson for Queensland.
Great little side stat. Who loaded you up with that? Big cue ball Hull? Or
it was, I think Queensland tweeted it in the end. So I was just scrolling through X and I found it. And yeah, I thought that's pretty cool.
Yeah. So a good game of cricket. I mean, some other highlights emerging was Marnus's 150. So that's his fourth 100 of the domestic summer, as well as 100 in a club T20. So this is a guy who's in white hot form, is batting the house down. And as we have said, is now a lock for the first test. Other things that caught my eye, this is the second loss of the defending champions season in Shield cricket out of two games. They're going to have to get a move on, I think, if they're going to be in and around the hoop come finals time.
Footy, Teddy would be saying, oh, it's a premiership hangover. It's amazing what's happened. Sort of got caught sniffing themselves. They're a little too happy with how last year went. They need to start moving on with things.
They have to move on with things. And the other thing that caught my eye is the old Instagram boomerangs. The England cricket team will have Usman Khawaja's dismissal in the second innings on boomerang in the change room. Ooh. So ball going across him, fourth stump full, not full length, full, like just probably hitting three quarters up the stumps, going across him, getting him to drive. Feet not moving as well as they could and caught behind. So they are, where I think a few of the other batters, they're going to go hard at them, back of a length, try and ruffle them up short. They're going to hone into a few key tactics. One is if they go over the wicket to him, as I just said, that pitching third stump full of length, and trying to get him caught behind. Or, of course, we've seen round the wicket coming into middle and off, but the same length. The key is the length that they're going to bowl to him. They're going to force him to come forward from round the wicket, LBW and bowled, from over the wicket, caught behind. There'll be no short stuff. None whatsoever.
So it's almost a fuller length than what you'd bowl to any other batsman.
Well, he hangs back, sure, because he's a hang backer, and more so now than he ever has been. And so if you think of that, when they put those little pitch graphs up, and a good length is 6 meters, essentially 5 or 6 meters is a good hard length. 2 meters is kind of very full / almost half volley. They're going to be in the 2.5 meter to 3 meter.
So if you
area, like if you're bowling, very very full.
If you're bowling there to Steve Smith, you're getting absolutely like carted. He's jumping on the front
hey,
foot.
Travis Head's
driving you everywhere. Yeah,
100%. Travis Head's smashing through the covers. It's will have a very unique length to Usman. If they're doing their homework, which I'm sure they are.
Yeah. Gee, that's and obviously Perth start as well. Fast, bouncy pitch, so they're going to have to be very disciplined not to not to drop a little too short to Usman Khawaja, but it's a great breakdown. Starts for McSweeney, so 41-26. Jason Sanger, half centuries in each innings, but I tend to agree with your statement earlier that it feels like this. There's only a handful of guys in contention here now. Weatherald is, as you said, you've got him high up in the piece. I'd probably still think he's a little bit of a smoky. Constis, Webster, Green, Marnus. I think the makeup of the team and the vacant spots are going to be made up of some kind of combination of those five. Tasmania and WA.
What a game.
This Shield game that I always reference going back a few years ago now, where you were able to score some big runs, Teddy, and it all came down to the end, and Ashley Nofke bowling to Brady Jones at the end with all four results in play, and they've done it again. The waning moments of the game on day four, Tasmania winners by 3 runs, and that doesn't even tell half the story. So chasing 259 to win, WA were 8 for 200. Game was over. Thought no chance from here. 8 down, still needing another 60. Joel Curtis, who's been one of the finds in domestic cricket. WA do it again with the wicketkeepers. It's amazing the amount that just kept coming through. So Philippi goes to New South Wales. Inglis gets more opportunities in the national team. And all of a sudden, Curtis has grabbed his opportunity, scored a very nice half century. And all of a sudden, still 8 down, WA are within 7 runs of victory. Now all of a sudden, it's looking like WA is going to get there with support from Rocciccioli. And up until this stage in the game, Teddy, there had been 38 wickets fall. How many of them do you think fell due to LBW?
Don't tell me none.
0.
No.
And the last 2 wickets to fall are both LBW decisions. So how about that for the umpire in that moment to go, as Curtis gets wrapped on the pads by Riley Meredith, game on the line, finger goes up, Curtis is out.
Yeah.
3 more runs added by Haskett and Rocciccioli before Haskett is then out, LBW bird, and that is the end of the game. Tasmania win late on day 4 by 3 runs.
Yeah, hell of a game of cricket. I mean, Curtis's LBW is 50-50 at best in the favour of Tasmania. Outside the line, from around the wicket, anyway, was given out, and then the next one's probably, I don't know.
But how's that for a backdrop?
Maybe missing leg, so to go from 0
haven't
to
paid an LBW and they pay that one in that moment.
Oh, unbelievable. So, a great game of cricket. The thing that caught my eye in that game is Haskett, actually. The left armer, tall, fast, had the ball on a string earlier in the game. So, there's a name. I wouldn't say cricket in Australia is flushed with high-quality left-arm bowlers, Spencer Johnson there or thereabouts, but I don't know if you have any more colour on him and his story, but he looked every piece of bowler in that Shield game.
Mm. I don't, but I can find a little more about him. The rest of the match, for whatever it's worth, so Weatherald with 94 in the second dig, keeps his name in it, had 18 in the first innings, Bancroft missing out in each innings, but what a game of cricket. What a game of cricket.
Do you think Cam Bancroft just needs a little breather?
Well, expand.
Sorry, caught you off guard. I'll pick them. Yeah, I mean, you mentioned Cam Bancroft. I feel a bit sorry for him because, this is the second domestic summer that he's come back from the UK and struggled early on in the season. You get a sense, a bit like Marnus, what he went through. Without being on that constant treadmill, you don't get that opportunity to take a step back and actually really have a look in the mirror as to where the holes in your game are. So it almost feels like he needs a little breather away from cricket just to go back to a few basics. And that's obviously not going to happen this summer unless he gets dropped. And, the way he's playing, that's a consideration with such a strong WA team. But, going back to county cricket every year on that treadmill, he might be better off just downing tools for a bit.
Mm. I think he signed a multi-year deal too, hasn't he? So the plan would be for him to go back and continue to play in the UK. He plays with Gloucestershire, doesn't he? So
he does.
I think he's planning to go back there and even captain the team, I think, on occasions in the season just gone by. I've just done a little more research as we go on Liam Haskett. So we would have spoken about him last year. Remember he made his debut for the Adelaide Strikers and he got hit for 6 And the catch.
His dad caught him.
His dad took the catch in the crowd. So he's on Big Bash debut. He gets hoiked over the rope, and then his dad, Lloyd Haskett, who's a former WAFL footballer, took the catch in the crowd. So that is Liam Haskett, playing for WA out of Claremont Netherlands, left arm quick. So all the best to him. And there you go. He's caught your eye, Teddy, early in his domestic career. Just on the one-day cup, full round of fixtures, everyone that you played in the Shield, you play again in the one days, exactly how it should be. It's not that hard, is it? But the Shield game and the one day together, and we can swing around the States on that front. What else we got, Teddy? Just on domestic cricket and Nick Maddison, obviously, who we probably learnt the story during the week, and one which I'm sure you would have been privy to for a little longer than that. Shout out to him. I mentioned this yesterday as part of the broadcast. One of my favourite guys to interview. I feel like he's such a popular guy in the locker room, and he's also one of those people, and in our job, I'm lucky enough to interview a lot of athletes, and so many of them are so well media trained nowadays that you feel like when you speak to them, almost like they run everything through a computer and spit out all these cliches. I feel like when I interviewed Nick Maddison, he's the kind of guy that you ask him a question and he properly considers it, thinks about it, and then spits out a very honest answer. It doesn't run through the same kind of modern day computer that that a lot of athletes kind of go through. And I always find it really refreshing when we get the chance to chat on ABC Radio. But at 33, at the end of last off-season, when he was planning to go away on holiday, he basically discovered a lump, which turned out to be testicular cancer. He had surgery on that, and then 7 weeks later was informed that the cancer had spread. He underwent chemotherapy and ended up with 3 cycles of chemo spaced 3 weeks or lasting for 3 weeks at a particular time. It ended in July, and 8 weeks later, he received the good news that the chemo had worked and he could begin his journey back to playing cricket and continue, obviously, in his journey in life. But to think that's been going on since the last time that the cricket season's gone away, I mean, our thoughts are with Nick, and are awesome that it's turned out this way. And he wanted to tell his story almost as a cautionary tale to tell people that, hey, if you have something you're not sure about, it's best to get it checked out. He said, look, I grew up in the country. First thought was, oh, it'll be fine, it'll go away, she'll be right. But instead to make sure you get it checked out, because imagine if he hadn't, and the fact that he had and ends up having a successful result from something that could have been a whole lot worse.
Yeah, I mean, we're all incredibly happy, he's made the recovery that he had, because, it's hard to fathom what he's been through and what he would have gone through having, not gone to get the treatment as quickly as he did. As you said, a great fella, a good cricketer, but cricket kind of goes into the back burner in times like this. Yeah. And the thing that, always makes me think, there are no secrets in sport these days, and yet I'm surprised how well this was contained out of respect for Nick and his request just to get better. And that's the type of person he is. He's a private guy. So, just a what might have been story, and so glad that, the dice have fallen where they have in terms of his health now. So hopefully, fingers crossed, we get to see him play cricket again. That would be it. A great cream on the cake.
Just around the world in some other cricketing news, Teddy, the Women's World Cup continues. The Aussies are undefeated. They've had a washout. They've won their other games. They've got 2 to go in the tournament. They play England on Wednesday and then South Africa on Saturday. Of course, you can find those games through the ABC Listen app. I think the other two teams that are really in contention to win the title are clearly the host nation, India, and England. So the big three that we talk about so often in world cricket are certainly the big three in the women's game. Last night, India played England, and it was a thrilling game of cricket. So England made 288, and in the end, India fell 4 runs short. So England getting home to win by 4 runs there. So you'd imagine we'll see both those teams again in the semi-final. England officially booked their place in the last 4, so they're there, along with the Australians, and India still have a bit of work to do just to make sure they clinch one of those final 4 spots.
Yeah, they do have some work to. Heather Knight, 100 and a 300th cap last night to get England home, a great fixture. It's a great World Cup that actually deserves more attention. I think we do a great job in Australian cricket. Australia do a phenomenal job of promoting women's cricket. I don't get the sense that the ICC feel the same. And there are a few data points here. This is, in true, and maybe it's become the ICC way, but poor scheduling, poor local advertising that means, and maybe it's ticket prices, there's very few people there. If this was in Australia, we'd be seeing packed out crowds, mm-hmm. I think, and would be thoughtful around how it was scheduled. Why they would play games, day-night games in Sri Lanka, when I think, the monthly average of rain is 10 inches or, in the month of October, and most of that comes at night after the build-up of the humidity through the day. It just feels like a bit of a slap in the face. Every 4 years there's a World Cup. The ICC only has one job now, and that is to put on events. They do nothing else. And so some thoughtfulness around how they could have done this better. I hope they have a bit of a retrospective because, the best women cricketers in the world deserve better.
It's well said, absolutely, particularly when a nation like India is involved. And in the not-too-distant past, we saw games involving Australia and India in front of packed houses and everything else. So there's an appetite there big time for the women's game and to be able to support it. But whether that's happened across the board and across the tournament is another thing. So final top four make the knockout stage. So it's 1v4, 2v3, and then they go straight through to a final. There's only eight teams in the tournament, Teddy, so we often have various World Cups where the numbers go all the way out and we end up with 16 to 20 teams, then all of a sudden they come all the way in. This is one of the latter. So there's only eight teams. You play the other seven sides in it, and then you have a top four, and away we go from there.
Yeah.
South Africa's on a bit of a heater. They're 4-1. It all depends sort of who you play when. And India, obviously, have now lost three in a row. So India still have two games to play against New Zealand, which is a bit of a banana peel game. They should win that. And then also against Bangladesh, which you think they knock that over and they'll still be there in the final four. But they really can't afford too many slip-ups. And for South Africa, they still have to play Pakistan, who they should beat. And then the Australians, obviously, who look like the best team in it to finish. Still on the world game, the defending Test World Champions, South Africa, are back playing cricket. And we love this, where there's an ODI or a T20 in one country, and then the very next day, just about, there's a Test match starting somewhere else. But the two games that South Africa played, the Proteas, their national team, Teddy, had one thing in common. They didn't win either of them.
Two reasonable upsets. The Test team losing to Pakistan, who
haven't beaten anyone for years.
Literally haven't. Don't know one end of a cricket bat from the other in Test cricket recently. And their T20 team to lose to Namibia, which was played at this great new ground that's been unveiled, and the place was, the place was rocking. So good to see cricket alive and well in a country like Namibia. And then, I don't love the whole two different teams in two different continents, but so be it. A pretty good test, and good to see Pakistan cricket give it to them, really.
Yeah. Quinny de Kock played in that game too for South Africa that lost to Namibia. Yeah, so he was back playing for South Africa. They needed 11 runs in Namibia off the last over, and they got them at that new venue, which, as you said, is a sort of bespoke ground for the 50-over World Cup, obviously, in 2027. Yes. We sort of talked about the game, and obviously that World Cup's off into the distance, and it feels like all the time in white ball cricket in particular, you're always viewing them through the next major tournament. What do you make of what's happening with India and the Roco combination that Rohit Sharma and Virat Kohli, the only version of the game that they still play for India are the ODIs, which is puzzling in itself to think that that's the one format of the game they're still going around in. And so you sort of immediately draw the dots where you think, well, if they're playing now, does that mean they're part of the plans for 2027? Rohit will be 40 by that time. He's lost a lot of weight. He's looking very fit. And Virat Kohli, who obviously missed out yesterday. It's the first time we've seen them really pick up a cricket bat in a professional setting since the IPL. And the first time that they've turned out for Team India since lifting the Champions Trophy back in March. And unsurprisingly, a little rusty. Didn't get too many. They ended up with eight between them, and Rohit scored all of those.
Did you just unveil a new relation? You know how, like, you've got
the Roco,
the Benifer.
I think, that, it, I think the Crick Info's been rolling with that. I just pinched it off them, but yeah.
I haven't heard that before. I mean, for all the reasons that Virat Kohli gave up Test cricket, we saw again yesterday. You know, playing away from his body, not really moving into the ball. I mean, I have no idea why these two are still playing ODI cricket. I mean, aside from the fact that they love it, but you're right. You're halfway through a World Cup cycle in a team that should be building towards that World Cup. So you're right. Maybe they are thinking that they're going to be a part of that and that's going to be their swan song. It's not a home World Cup, and so it kind of has that different feeling to it, but who knows? Oh, it's hard to keep track of.
It's also in November, December that year. So it's not like it's, oh, as soon as we get to 2027, it's the World Cup. It's more than 2 years away now. The other thing is that there's a general consensus and feeling, if you sort of put your finger in the wind around Indian cricket, that team management's handling of the situation wasn't great. I mean, these guys are like, you know, demigods in India, for example, and it was always going to get awkward towards the back end as to what it looked like. Kohli firstly lost the captaincy, and yeah, that left, I think, a sour taste in his mouth and a lot of his fans. So Rohit ends up taking over that. Kohli completes the series in Australia, but then we don't see him again after that. Obviously, he doesn't make the trip to the UK and really retires on Instagram. That was when we found out about that. And for Rohit Sharma, he obviously departed the scene after the Melbourne Test, didn't even get to Sydney, and that's how his Test career ended, albeit didn't have the sort of long, glittering career the same way that you know, someone like Virat had. And then even with the T20 format of the game, it felt like, again, that they were almost trying to be pushed out of the lineup, that it was, you know, it's time for them to move on. And instead, they went all the way through and they won it. So it was almost like this, you know, two-finger salute back to team management to say, oh, well, have a little bit of that. And now they're still playing in the 50-over version of the game where I'm sure there'd be a thinking somewhere from the selectors that, oh, these guys will sort of move on naturally. And I wonder if they're just making it a little awkward here for Team India to say, hey, what are you going to do? They've got Yashasvi Jaiswal, who's one of the best batsmen in the world, sitting on the sidelines. He can't get into the team. And you've got Rohit and Virat in the top three. What point does it get to where they go, what are we doing, guys? Are you going to the World Cup? If that's the case, I'm not sure that's your decision. And then what do we do with Yashasvi in the meantime? Shubman's also in the top three. This just screams awkward.
It does scream awkward. It screams like it's going to end up in a little bit of a train wreck. I mean, make no mistake, these two, they won't get unselected from this team. They'll have to step down. You don't get the sense that they're planning on doing that anytime soon. So in India, when your name is Sharma or Kohli, and previously it was Dhoni or Tendulkar, you run your own race. And so I think they'll probably put their own interests first here.
If you're picking an ODI team right now and you've got Virat Kohli, Rohit Sharma and Yashasvi Jaiswal, who are you picking?
Jaiswal. Yeah. I think there's no room in modern ODI cricket for 38-year-old batsmen. I don't care if you've been on GLP-1s or not. It's time to move on. It really is.
That'll just about do us. We started where we ended in the end on the Grandstand Cricket Podcast. Enjoy the next 2 weeks without me. I'm taking a little vacay. We'll see if I can run into Jack up there in the sky at 30,000 feet and see how we go.
So before we go,
ooh,
maybe you missed the news on your little wedding vibe.
I love that we're doing this at the end, by the way, because it's a reward for the true Grandstand Cricket Podcast believers that have stayed all the way to the end of the pod.
We have a live show date, Corb.
A date?
We have a date in the diary
mm-hmm.
that currently, let me look this up, Wednesday the 26th of November. Put it in your diary.
Wednesday, November 26th.
Sydney. Yep.
In Sydney.
Yep. And in actual fact, I'm happy for maybe we'll run a quiz in coming weeks.
Mm-hmm.
Or lucky listeners, we'll take them to Corb's Curry Club afterwards. We'll go have a vegetarian curry and a schooner with four lucky listeners.
How good.
You can hand over that ABC credit card.
Love it.
The platinum ABC Amex.
Love We'll have to search pretty hard for that. That sounds like a whole lot of fun. So live show Sydney, November 26, Wednesday. That is at the completion of the Perth test. So Perth test will be the first one of the summer, obviously. So we'll have a whole lot to discuss, Teddy, after the first test, whatever happens over there. Feels like it's going to be a huge tone setter for the summer, and I'll see you in Sydney on the 26th of November. I'll be chatting to you long before then. I'll be back by early November, and we'll have the runway into the first test in Perth. Good luck with coach for the next 2 weeks. Thank you very much for all of that, Teddy. I'll chat to you soon.
Later.